Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, as Australia introduces a levy on social media giants, we explore how similar rules have played out in Canada. Also today...
This is end-of-life car tyres recycled with graphene. I want to make space stations. I want to make world's tallest buildings.
It was once hailed as a wonder ingredient for industry, but what has happened to graphene? And hear how sport diplomacy is being used to strengthen ties between Australia and Papua New Guinea.
This deal is designed to stop Papua New Guinea entering a security agreement with another country, China in particular.
But what's the financial cost? Find out in the next half an hour. First today, let's head to France, where President Macron is poised to name a new prime minister after the collapse of the government. The 2025 budget was scrapped after Michel Barnier resigned as prime minister following a no-confidence vote in Parliament over his budget. So who is in the frame to replace him? Let's see if Charlotte de Montpellier has any answers. She's a senior economist at ING Economic Research, and she covers the French economy. So who are the runners and the riders, Charlotte?
Difficult to say, actually. So they probably will be someone from the middle. So there are a few names around. But the difficulty is that they need to have an agreement between the left and the right and the middle, because otherwise it will be again the same as with Barnier, a government and then no confidence vote again. So it's very, very difficult. It's been a few days that Macron promises that he will actually announce someone, but at this moment, they still seems to not agree. So there is no name yet. And maybe we will have to wait for a couple of days more.
Well, the political turmoil has already taken a toll on business confidence. Earlier, I spoke to Bart Kiss, the CEO of the Paris-based tech firm Powder AI.
There is a sense that investment in private companies is drying up. I've heard from friends working in venture capital that the current level of private investments in France was definitely less since the dissolution of the parliament last summer. So it has an impact for private companies, for sure, in the tech sector in particular.
You've had a fair bit of money from the government, haven't you, as part of your kind of startup? Presumably as well, that's dried up.
Measures associated with funding innovations in France have held still. There has been passionate discussions associated with what would happen of them in the next year budget, but that fell through. I believe that it's really important for France in particular, but for Europe in general, to innovate so that we can try to play catch up with the economic development of a country like the US. And it's certainly not by adding more charges to innovative companies and startups that this would happen.
Well, that might be the thing that has to happen in order to bring down that deficit.
It's something. It's a point of view. Right now, in terms of taxation, France has 46% of the GDP being taxed, which is 12 points above than OECD. That means that France is heavily taxed already. So it feels like public expenditure and taxation could go down in tandem. And when it comes to investment in R&D, France invests 2.3% of the GDP in R&D, which is behind countries like Germany at 3.1% or South Korea at 4.6%. So France has to innovate, and cutting measures associated with innovations and startups is not going to help.
Is it possible for a business right now to kind of anticipate what might happen with the government?
We would all love to say yes. The French political spectrum right now is a bit upside down, to be honest with you. We hope that reasonable parties will manage to find a way out of the current political vacuum. And we see that landing on a consensus and collective agreement is more and more difficult in today's algorithmic democracies. I call them algorithmic democracies because they lean so much on how public opinion is being formed on social media. And it feels like, from that perspective, social media is bringing us further and further instead of creating this togetherness.
Just finally, what would you like to see in a new budget?
It feels like collectively we need to take decisions that involve making sacrifices, but it shouldn't come at the expense of people who are working hard to make France successful economically, in my opinion.
That was Bart Kiss. He's the CEO of Powder AI. It's a tech firm based in Paris. Charlotte de Montpellier is still with us. She's from ING. So that's what Bart Kiss has to say. He works in tech. What are other sectors in France feeling? How are they feeling at the moment? Are they feeling as uncertain and sort of despondent as Bart was feeling?
Yes, actually, when we look at all surveys that are done by the Banque de France, for instance, it's clear that the sentiment is down. So companies are very much afraid and uncertain about what is going to happen next. The issue, of course, is that the budgetary situation of France is very, very bad, with a deficit above 6% of GDP. So everyone knows that at some point there will be a need of an increased taxation or a decrease in expenses. And the big uncertainty is whether there will be a government to decide actually on something, or that otherwise it would be a bigger problem. So a lot of uncertainty, and this is clearly weighing on economic growth in France, and growth is weakening quite strongly due to this uncertainty.
You mentioned the sticking point is the deficit, and any new budget is going to have to deal with this. In the meantime, though, you're still working with the 2024 budget. What is that doing to the economy? Presumably that deficit is getting bigger and bigger.
Yes, exactly. So right now there is no budget for 2025. So the idea is to roll out the budget of 2024 into 2025. But it means that there is nothing done in order to improve the situation on public finance front. So deficit will still be around 6% of GDP next year if we continue like that without a budget for 2025. And this is, of course, a very big problem, because it means that the pain later to go into the right direction will be even bigger. And at the same time, growth is weakening. So then it's even more difficult to bring the deficit down when you have very weak economic growth, and growth is weakening because of uncertainty and the political situation.
Marine Le Pen, who is a prominent French politician, has said that bringing that budget gap down by 3% of economic output by 2029 is not credible or reasonable, and that we should be doing it over a longer period of time.
So that's a bit the issue. A lot of politicians wants to avoid bringing down the deficit, because it's much more comfortable for them to continue spending a lot of money. The issue is that it does not follow the rule, the EU rule, and they need to follow the EU rule. And we also know that financial markets are getting a bit worried about the situation. We have seen that spreads went up quite strongly when the government of Michel Barnier went down. And so that's a big problem, because at some point, if markets do not want to give money to France anymore, then it's even more difficult. And it means that there is even more pain in order to bring public finance back in order. So it's very easy to say, but everyone knows that at some point they will need to make an effort.
Charlotte de Montpellier from ING, thank you very much for joining us today on World Business Report. Let's move on to our next story, and we're going to head to Australia for this one, where the government plans to introduce a levy on social media companies and search engines to require them to pay media outlets for news content republished on their platforms. So this will come in January under the news bargaining incentives, and it will require tech companies that earn more than $160 million US a year to pay publishers for their content. And if they don't do it, they'll face higher taxes. Companies affected include Facebook's owner Meta, Alphabet, which owns Google. Australia's Communications Minister Michelle Rowland spoke about the plan at a news conference in Sydney.
The news bargaining incentive is critical to ensuring that digital platforms contribute to the sustainability of journalism in Australia. By establishing the news bargaining incentive, the government is ensuring that large digital platforms are incentivised to either renew or enter into commercial deals to remunerate Australian news organisations.
So the new rules in Australia are similar to those already implemented in Canada. Canada's Online News Act mandates the digital news intermediaries to negotiate with news publishers to ensure that they're fairly compensated for their content. And this legislation came into effect in the summer of 2023. Well, joining us now is Taylor Owen. He is the founding director of the Centre for Media, Technology and Democracy and is also the principal investigator at the Media Ecosystem Observatory. And you've been looking, haven't you, at the impact that this law has had in Canada since 2023. And initially, rather than pay any content, Meta actually blocked access to news on Facebook and Instagram. So how has that impacted the news sites?
Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating to watch. I mean, the question really is what happens when you take journalism off of one of the big social platforms in which people share information in Canada, like in Australia and elsewhere. It's worth flagging that Google actually responded to the regulation by paying $100 million a year into a fund that will fund Canadian journalism. So Google actually complied with the regulation in that way, in what I would argue is largely a positive way. Meta, on the other hand, complied to the regulation by blocking news, right? They said, if you're going to make us compensate for linking to news, then we will just block them. And the effect's been quite dramatic. I mean, at the total level, it's meant a loss of 11 million views of journalism a day in Canada.
And how are consumers feeling about that? Are they disappointed? Well, do they want to get their news through, you know, those particular social media apps?
So this is fascinating too. We ask Canadians regularly how they consume and share their news. And one of the things we found is that for a majority of the people who say they get their news from Meta, from Facebook and Instagram, they say they still get their news from there, despite the fact there's no more journalism.
Right. So how's that working?
I think that, well, I mean, it could mean many things. One theory is that people define news as something very different than journalism. They see it as information about the world shared by influencers or by their friends and family or by random people on Facebook and Instagram. Right. And so I think that should make the news industry and journalism in general reflect a bit on what their place is in the value of citizens when they look at news.
So you mentioned
so largely people haven't noticed, but it's hard to imagine there hasn't been an effect, right? You take away 11 million views of journalism a day in a democracy, and like that clearly has an effect on.
And has there been a financial cost then to some of those media organizations?
Absolutely, and quite significant. About a quarter of all news platforms that were on Meta products before have now removed themselves and don't participate at all in any social media ecosystem. 98% of those are local. So the effect has been bigger on local, particularly independent local publishers, many of whom have gone out of business. So if you were a small publisher who relied on traffic from Facebook or Instagram, you took a real hit under this policy.
What then, just briefly, Taylor, would be your advice to Australia as they embark on this on January the 1st?
Well, I mean, in many ways, Australia was before Canada. The News Media Bargaining Code, which is now a few years old, is what Canada developed our model off of and I think improved on a bit. My view is a democratic society has every right to impose these kinds of laws. And if the result of that is journalism leaving the country and a company that's benefited tremendously from having journalism on its platform over the last decade responds to that by blocking journalism in a democratic society, that the blame for that is on them, not on the democratic government. I think Australia should push through and see this democratic policy through.
Thank you very much, Taylor Owen, for joining us today from British Columbia in Canada. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. Now, do you remember a material called graphene? It was first discovered at Manchester University in the north of England more than two decades ago. There was a frenzy of excitement over its potential because of its extraordinary properties. Super strong, thin, flexible and conductive. So what's happened to the industry now? Well, our reporter James Graham has been finding out.
Here in Manchester, the university has become a centre for research into graphene and other 2D materials. There are two new buildings, one focused on nurturing new ideas and the other on commercialization. That's called the Graphene Engineering and Innovation Centre, also known as the GEIC. So I'm just going to go inside and meet the person who runs it, James Baker.
Welcome to the Graphene Engineering Innovation Centre. So in this lab here, our composites lab, what we're doing is investigating how we add graphene into something to start to transform the performance of that component. And we're doing some recent tests where you can increase the strength by as much as 100%. So in the GEIC, we work with industry. So everything from slabs that go into tracks for driving JCBs and lorries over, can we make them thinner using more sustainable material for the lighter weight? We had one partner who produced packaging for nails. By adding a small amount of graphene into the packaging, they were able to reduce the amount of packaging. I think it was by 90 tons per year of plastic. So things like packaging, bottles, flooring, plastic bags, PPE.
I've got to say, this wasn't what I expected, because I had it in my mind as the material of the future, you know, rollable screens for your laptop, other aviation uses, but now you're talking about plastic bottles and PPE.
So we can go lots of areas with graphene. We can go from aircraft to electronics. The near-term application, the paints, the coatings, the composites, the concrete, are where you start to see products happening now.
This is a crucial point. 10 years ago, the hype was about futuristic uses, but the reality has been in enhancing everyday materials by adding a little bit of graphene, creating composites. A report from the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany said the graphene market was worth $100 million in 2022, and that's across three sectors: electronics, batteries and composites. That's expected to grow into the billions this decade.
I don't need the specs on.
You don't need the specs now.
James took me to see Vivek Conchery, whose business, Graphene Innovations Manchester, specialises in enhancing materials by adding graphene.
This is a very simple entrance doormat for houses and office spaces. This is end-of-life car tyres recycled with graphene. The main reason we use graphene is for enhancing the performance of the product. An example, when you recycle something, the biggest challenge, the performance keeps dropping. By adding graphene, we can enhance it. We tested with other recycled mats in the market. This is 5 times stronger. One thing is, I do have bigger vision as well. An example, I want to make space stations. I want to make world's tallest building. So sustainability is important, but we do have bigger ambitions. So, you know, the scape.
It's a good range, isn't it? Doormats to space stations.
From floor top to space.
Yeah. Where has your investment come from? Is that from other private investors or public bodies?
So my initial investment I got mostly from US and Canada. Now I have investors in Switzerland, and even University of Manchester invested. So there are investors from all over the world.
Those international investors reflect the global nature of this nascent industry and where that crucial money is coming from to help develop these ideas. And different parts of the world are trying different approaches to kickstart an industry and corner the market.
In China, you have a national government that is underwriting and pushing and prioritizing graphene.
That's Terence Barkin, executive director of trade body the Graphene Council.
The European Union, with a dedicated program that raised the visibility of graphene, but I would argue did not deliver as promised on the commercialization aspect as much as they might consider themselves to have done.
That was Terence Barkin finishing that report from James Graham. Now, a quick quiz. Let's see if you can tell who was ringing the bell for the opening of the New York Stock Exchange on Thursday, just from the sound. Well, did you guess? Well, I'll tell you, it was President-elect Trump, whose vigorous bell ringing may be part of being named Time Magazine's Person of the Year earlier in the day. Emma Wall was watching. She is Investment and Research Director at Hargreaves Lansdown. Do you think then this event, Mr. Trump ringing the bell, reflects his relationship with New York and Wall Street?
Yeah, a ringing endorsement for Wall Street from Donald Trump. I think you could write the headline. We've definitely seen markets react really positively to Donald Trump being re-elected. Interestingly, it's only the first time he's rung the bell, despite being a New York resident. The second time he's been called Time Person of the Year, though, the first time was in 2016 when he was elected last time around. We have been doing our outlook for 2025, and we're pretty bullish, so we're, you know, pretty positive on the outlook for US smaller companies because of Trump's policies of kind of lower corporation tax. But we do think it's smaller companies which are likely to be more domestic because of those tariffs. So it won't just be international businesses that will be hurt by the tariffs. There will be some US businesses too, which is why we think that sweet spot is US smallers. But yeah, Trump is pro Wall Street.
The European Central Bank has reduced interest rates by a quarter point to 3% today on Thursday, but they've also cautioned that growth will be weaker than previously expected. I was looking at the number of times the ECB has reduced rates since June. It's four. Compare that with the Federal Reserve, that they've only reduced rates twice this year so far. Explain for us the difference. Why the difference?
It's all to do with economic health. So we've heard today from the ECB not just a 25 basis point or quarter of a percent cut. We've also heard that they're downgrading growth for the euro region for this year and next year. And it's a similar story that we had from the OECD last week, where they said actually only three of the G7 countries are expected to manage growth of more than 1% next year. You know, we've seen all the issues going on with France at the moment with its debt levels and its spending levels. Germany has also been challenged in terms of economic growth over the last year. So really, this is indication of the fact that actually the US economy, although slowing from where it was in the first half of the year, is in much ruder health than the European economies.
Emma Wall, it's always a pleasure to have you on the programme, Head of Investment and Research at Hargreaves Lansdown. Now, finally today, we're going to head back to Australia because Australia and Papua New Guinea have announced a multi-million dollar deal to establish a rugby league team in Port Moresby. The PNG team will join Australia's National Rugby League from 2028, marking the competition's most ambitious expansion yet. The agreement also carries significant political implications, aiming to prevent China from gaining a security foothold in Papua New Guinea, Australia's closest neighbour. The BBC's Phil Mercer is in Sydney, and I spoke to him about why Australia is investing so heavily in sporting diplomacy.
The Australian Prime Minister is a man called Anthony Albanese, and he says that this deal is a great arrangement, a great day for both countries. In Papua New Guinea, his counterpart is James Marape, and he says the deal is pivotal in anchoring this bilateral relationship. Now, experts we speak to say that this is the biggest act of sporting diplomacy ever in the Pacific. This deal is designed to stop Papua New Guinea entering a security agreement with another country, China in particular.
And why does Australia have such concerns about China in the Pacific?
A couple of years ago, in 2022, China signed a security agreement with Solomon Islands. PNG is Australia's nearest neighbour. If you go to the right-hand side, going eastwards, you pretty soon come to the Solomon Islands, another geographically strategic area. So China's security agreement with Solomon Islands did cause a great deal of concern in Australia. And China has also reached out to Papua New Guinea wanting a similar security agreement with PNG. Ian Kemish, who's a former Australian High Commissioner to Papua New Guinea, he's now an academic at the University of Queensland. He believes that Australia should be wary of China's ambitions in the Pacific region.
We've seen in some other parts of the Pacific what Chinese influence has done to erode government commitment to things like media freedom and political freedoms. You know, we've seen that to some extent in Solomon Islands. We've seen it, echoes of it in places like Vanuatu and Kiribati.
Papua New Guineans love rugby league, though, don't they? So how are they reacting to the news that they'll have their own team in Australia's world-class competition in 2028?
To say that rugby league is an obsession in Papua New Guinea is a huge understatement. The game is paramount in PNG. Now that they will have their own team in Australia's National Rugby League, which is the best rugby league competition in the world. But we've also been speaking to Oliver Nobertau. He is a Papua New Guinean researcher at the Lowy Institute. That's a Sydney-based think tank. And he believes that the money that's being spent on this NRL deal in Port Moresby could have been better spent elsewhere.
The question that's being asked is, if both countries at this stage can agree to put this much money into a rugby team, why can't the same effort sort of be carried over and put into, say, you know, the education and health services, you know, sort of boosting support in these areas?
How are Australians feeling about this? Because it's costing around 600 million Australian dollars. That's nearly 400 million US dollars. That's a lot of money for taxpayers.
It is. It's a lot of money to spend on a sport that isn't based in your country. Certainly here in Eastern Australia, news that there will be another team in the National Rugby League in 2028 will cause a great deal of excitement. It is bone-crunchingly exciting if you like your sport in a very combative, relentless way. That's the National Rugby League. In other parts of Australia, they'll be pretty lukewarm about this deal.
Port Moresby is one of the most dangerous cities in the world. So I was just wondering, how will they encourage players to go from Australia?
We understand that certain players are likely to get tax exemptions on their wages in Australia if they are based in Papua New Guinea.
That was Phil Mercer reporting for us and bringing us to an end to World Business Report for today. The producer was Matt Lines. The studio engineer was James West. And you can join Will Bain tomorrow. He will be in the hot seat. Do join him if you can. I'm Sam Fenwick. Thank you very much for listening today.